Who is that?
Jazz.
Bastard.
All right, welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 126. He's Mike.
He's Pat.
And we're back. It's called Revenge of the Quickening of the Internet, Part 7. We're going to try this again, and we're talking about some piano players from mid-century and then one outlier. Mike, when you introduced this, you actually brought up an idea that maybe we needed a episode that was a little bit different from our recent one. So talk a little bit about your thought behind this one as to why it seemed like time to go back in time.
Well, we've been doing a lot of more recent stuff for a variety of reasons, and things that maybe a person who appreciates jazz would go, oh, those are names I know, that sounds interesting, as opposed to stuff that's happening right now that, you know, perhaps people haven't heard of or can't be bothered to care too much about. So we're interested in thinking about where the music's going and interest developments in the music, but it seemed to me that in recent podcasts, we'd gotten a little recent heavy, a little from 70s forward, and really a lot of quite recent stuff. And so I thought, let's go back and do some older stuff just to kind of balance out a little bit, look at some different things than we've looked at in the recent past. So
cool.
That was the idea.
Okay. So anyway, we're doing mainly work by some piano players. You want to talk about the selections?
Sure. We're looking at Mary Lou Williams' Zodiac Suite from the mid-40s. And then the first disc, keep forgetting, it's the Verve, right?
Yeah, Bud Powell on Verve.
Bud Powell on Verve. Because I have the Blue Note. For some reason, I just keep thinking Blue Note. I know why. Anyway, disc one of the complete Bud Powell on Verve, which comprises some albums of Bud at peak, if not performance, peak speed anyway. We'll talk about that. And then there's a two-disc set on Blue Note called The Complete Blue Note Recordings of Fats Navarro and Tad Dameron. And we're looking at the disc that has the Tad Dameron material on it. And then as an outlier, you threw in 2015 Ferret Odman's Dameronia Strings. So we're looking at that as well. Them's our selection.
Right. And while that's a modern recording, the Dameronia with strings, I feel like it's mood. It's kind of, I don't know, attitude towards the music is kind of rooted in those early 50s, late 40s. And most of these recordings are from around that time. Mary Lou Williams is 55. I think the Bud Powell was from sessions from like about 49, 48, or 50. And the Tad Dameron, Fats Navarro stuff is 47, 48. So kind of, we'll talk said, about the period there.
You said 55 on Mary Lou, and you meant 45.
Thank you. Thank you. Absolutely. 45. Yes. Thank you. That's correct. Zodiac Suite. It's a Smithsonian release. It's in pretty rough, muffled sound. It's kind of, I guess, a concept album. And I guess as I think about it, it can't have been an album, or I guess it could have been an album, because albums used to be little books that held a number of 78 RPM discs in them. And that's where that name came from, if you think about it, like a photograph album. But it was not an LP, obviously, in 1945. So I assume that she cut these tracks on, and I've not looked up their genesis, but it must have been a very, I'm assuming, a very small label. One reason I think we have trouble kind of tracing Mary Lou Williams' history is that she doesn't really have a long-term relationship with a major label in her career. And of course, a lot of her career takes place with artists like, you know, Andy Kirk and his, I can't remember, it's like Seven Clouds of Joy or some strange right. name. And, you know, again, it's a fine band, but it's not one of the best known bands of the big band period. And so she's kind of associated with artists who don't necessarily get a lot of documentation and were not, you know, considered historically central. if she played piano for, I don't know, I mean, it's kind of hard, Count Basie or Duke Ellington, one, she would have replaced the band leader, but two, the documentation would have been a lot more thorough. The spotlight would have been brighter. So this is your first recording by her, right? You had not listened to her, but you had taught her? Am I remembering right?
Yeah, in the jazz class I taught a couple of years ago, she comes up quite a bit in the literature, no doubt in part because in literature on jazz, there's always, of course, an attempt to be open-minded, or I shouldn't say always. In recent literature on jazz, there's an attempt to be aware of class issues, race issues, and gender issues. And of course, anytime you can find a female jazz player of note, especially pre, say, 1950, you sort of have to talk about her. So, you know, Lil Hardin Armstrong comes up a lot, for example. Sometimes Bessie Smith gets mentioned, and in this case, Mary Lou Williams seems to come up a lot. In some ways, she's has more jazz bona fides than either of those other two women, because Mary Lou Williams was a pianist, but also an arranger of some reputation, and is reasonably well known in the music, or was at one time, in the sense that players knew who she was. From what I've read, she was kind of a self-effacing personality. I think she got into the music through her husband, and I don't know if that connection continued throughout her career, but what I remember reading about her was that she was this self-effacing presence on the bandstand, sort of deliberately receding into the shadows, and literature about the music of the 40s and 50s has sort of unearthed her and kind of returned her, or tried to return her, to some prominence in the music. So it was just a name that I'd heard of, and a couple of students had dug up a couple recordings and listened to them and shared them with me. So that was as much as I knew about her. I knew she was important. I knew the Zodiac Suite was kind of known, or at least talked about, and I knew she was an arranger of some reputation. But that's really all I knew.
And frankly, you were hoping that this Zodiac Suite would have the sexy, sexy narration that our last Zodiac project had.
This is Aries Aram, ruled by the planet Mars, god of war.
Unfortunately not.
It does not.
Yeah, it's mid-40s, not mid-70s, alas, alack. Yet, there's a movie out about her called The Lady Who Swings the Band, which is also a song about her. Right now, I found that documentary, which I think is roughly 2014, is not yet streaming that I can find. It's not on YouTube. There are advertisements for it. There are certainly performances by Mary Lou on YouTube. And there's a couple
of... What's the name of that, by the way?
Again, it's The Lady Who Swings the Band. Unfortunately, there is a song written about Mary Lou Williams called The Lady Who Swings the Band. And so it's cute to name your documentary after a song, but of course, when you're searching for it, then you have to figure out, well, have I found a link to a performance of the song, or has this got to do with the documentary, et cetera, et cetera. Especially because she's still a fairly lesser known figure. Of course, the most striking thing about her as a woman in jazz is she doesn't sing. Yeah, she's a player, she's an arranger, but she's not a singer. And in many cases, certainly in the big band era, the goal of the singer was to be a pretty young woman that you put in front of the band, and her appeal was often as much visual as musical. But Mary Lou was somebody who was a musician's musician and who was not interested, I guess, in that kind of, you know, public display. It was more about performing. And you can imagine, you know, she's going from town to town on the band bus with a crew of people from Andy Kirk's group. You know, that's a tough life for anybody. It's going to be doubly tough for a African-American woman. So she really had to fight to kind of get her music heard and to be a working musician. It was not easy for her. This particular album, as we were saying, is, I guess, it Smithsonian did bring it out, and you'll notice in tributes to her or albums that she does later, even on her album that we both listened to, Keyboard History, and that's, I think, probably from 55. She will bring a tune or two from the Zodiac Suite into that. In other words, she'll keep a couple of them float in her repertoire for decades. But the thing about this is it's a very memorable concept. So I think in some ways it's one of the easier works of hers to kind of track down and fix on, because a lot of what she's got is either work with a big band where you're not going to hear much from her because that's just the way big bands work. Or trio work where a lot of what she's playing, it's just some of her tunes and then, you know, standards. And it's a little harder to get a fix on her personality from that work, at least as you're starting to get to know her. So people have gravitated to this, and it's, I don't know, maybe better known than it should be. I talked already about its muffled sound. Talk a little bit about its impression on you as just music.
Yeah, so my beef, or something we're going to talk about, or I hope we talk about in an upcoming episode, I have an issue, or I'm starting to have an issue with music that has names that seem to denote or connote something, and it's not always clear how the music relates to the thing it denotes or connotes. So this suite, the Zodiac Suite, all the songs are named for signs of the Zodiac, but I'll be damned if I can hear or detect any particular connection between any one number, any of the songs, and the particular sign it's associated with, right? Nat Adderley at least had a voice telling us Pisces is sexual or whatever, but
they were all sexual.
They're all sexual. Mary Lou Williams just, you know, it's just songs. And there's no obvious connection, and perhaps that's just because I'm astrologically illiterate, but it feels to me as if you could easily rearrange these and it wouldn't really matter very much. And that sort of gets on my nerves a little bit. I mean, I don't want to be a humbug here and complain about this kind of stuff, but it is something we've talked about, particularly with Wadada Leo Smith, and we're going to talk about it again when we listen to his massive two-disc set, America's National Parks. And the question, of course, is, what the heck does this music have to do with these names? Does it have anything to do with these names? So when I listen to these songs, I get no obvious connection. And in the aborted attempt we had at this a little bit earlier tonight, you pointed out, I think quite rightly, sometimes that's just a technique to get the composer inspired. It's a starting place for them so they can think of a zodiac sign and that can inspire them to noodle and produce some kind of sound. Okay, fine. But as a listener, it doesn't do anything for me. So my way into this is just to listen to the music itself. And it's perfectly pleasant, but it doesn't strike me as particularly jazzy. And we had sort of agreed on or talked about the term, you know, recital music. It's not quite classical, but it's not quite jazz. There's no funk in the butt on any of these. And it sounds very much like it's recorded on a piano that not long after this was set on fire and then given to Sun Ra to record most of his stuff on. I mean, it sounds like a kind of almost out of tune upright. The sound quality isn't great. I know Smithsonian probably did what they could with this, but it doesn't sound like it's recorded in a studio. It sounds like someone had a tape recorder in a living room and Mary was playing it upright. That's kind of how it sounds to me. And it sounds like a recital. It sounds a little bit like a recital that someone's playing for a group of intimate friends. As such, I enjoy these pieces. None of them are longer than three and a half minutes, but they don't particularly move me if they're meant to connote some, if they're meant to connect with some kind of emotion or convey some kind of emotion. I'm not feeling it. They don't seem particularly urgent. Sometimes they seem almost kind of noodly, and so they quickly become background music for me. I don't mind them. They don't hurt, but I take it I'm going to be more interested in Mary Lou Williams' reputation based on her arrangements and on that keyboard recital CD that we both listened to. That there's something there that's worth listening to. But this feels like a chamber exercise, a very private kind of exercise. I know she returns to this stuff in other settings, but this doesn't seem as if it's for others so much as it's for her. And so, as I say, it's enjoyable, but to me, it's not particularly moving. Now, some listeners may hear this and just be over the moon, but it's not me. And I take it wasn't you either.
Yeah, this is music that I've returned to periodically, and I think part of the barrier here is the sound quality. You know, she's not in RCA Studios. I don't know what label recorded this originally, but I'd bet money it wasn't a big one. So yeah. Music from this era is always struggling against the recording techniques of the time, but like a Duke Ellington, who was really kind of very smart about capturing his band on audio, get some amazing sounds. I was listening to some of his small group recordings, and I think the best, it was probably the French release, which is the best. And I mean, those are just, they're riveting. And part of that is the clarity, comparatively speaking, of the sound. Here it's very muffled. But yeah, you get the sense that these are new pieces that she's kind of almost feeling her way through. She's not comfortable with elaborating on them or improvising on them. She's kind of presenting them. And in a sense, that's the difficulty with a lot of jazz music now, is so much of it is based on originals by the artist. So there's no familiarity for the listener. You don't know what the variants are and what the original is it, you know, you just don't know where, you don't know it well enough to know what's being done to it. And here it seems like it's almost affecting her, that she's just kind of presenting the music, but doesn't have a lot to embroider on it. It's just kind of there. And they're not that memorable. Now, you know, some artists, Herbie Nichols, a lot of his recordings, he doesn't really do a lot of straight improvisation. It's almost presenting the melody. But of course, it's very rhythmically urgent. And the melodies, he's just a higher level composer, I think, at least as compared to this set of works. And it works as jazz. Of course, he's also dealing with some of the greatest rhythm sections that music's known. Whereas Mary here has got a bass on some of these. And then she's just by herself. And towards the end, yeah, especially I think the second half, just seems to become more and more, as you say, recital-like. It's more and more just piano, and it seems more recessive. And yeah, as a work, it is interesting, and it is. It serves that purpose of being memorable as a concept. I don't know if music is that memorable, but oh, she wrote a series of pieces on the zodiac signs. And again, it's kind of, you can remember that and hold it in your head as a narrative or a frame in a way that, oh, she recorded a series of sessions with musicians on standards. That said, if you run across the chronological classics of hers from 53 to 54, a one disc, there's some fantastic music on that with Don Byas, and all of it is just looser and more charismatic and more enjoyable than this, and certainly much, much jazzier. So if you want to hear her as a player, I'd look that up. I definitely look up a keyboard history. And the profiles I've been reading of her in the New Yorker, one from like 15 and one back in the 60s. The one from 15 stresses that she was a figure who kept changing and kept trying new things. So she's in Andy Kirk's band in the 30s, and I believe she's the one who writes the Trumpets No End arrangement of Blue Skies that Duke Ellington recorded, which is just a blast of an arrangement with Cat Anderson playing the melody 14 octaves too high at the end. And so she's quite a gifted arranger and composer. And she writes songs like Fungus Among Us. I mean, Among Us with a U. So she's clearly got a sense of humor and kind of a wit in about her that you just don't get here. I just don't think this is, unfortunately, it is the most, for me it was certainly, you know, if you're looking for something by Mary Lou, where do you begin? This seems like a natural part, right? You know, here she is as a composer, it's her album, but I don't know that it is the way to get to know her. I think it's probably something to listen to a little bit later down the road. I'm hoping that we can do a episode on Jerry Allen, who passed away this year, and she actually is in a group that towards the end of her life encounters this music. It does several of the numbers from the Zodiac Suite. And boy, that is a dull album. So I don't, you know, I'm like, man, this music doesn't seem, aside from a couple pieces that Mary Lou will return to ignite people. Yeah, one thing I learned from the interview with Mary Lou Williams is she had perfect pitch. And it's really fascinating if you've got access to the New Yorker archives electronically to go back there, because, you know, she talks about what it was like to be a young woman in an otherwise all-male big band on the road and some of the challenges she faced there. And then this later profile talks about the fact that really Mary Lou keeps getting better. And so we're starting with work from 45, but according to this writing, really 60s and 70s Mary Lou is the best Mary Lou. And she is at that point comfortable using harmonic devices that wouldn't be out of place in a Cecil Taylor performance at times. You know, she's constantly trying new things out. She's the Miles Davis of women piano players, or just, you know, maybe piano players. I don't know if there's any other one that morphed that much, but it does make her harder to get to know. And boy, after listening to this, I don't feel like I know her better. But yeah, I'd recommend listen to A Keyboard History. I think that's a lot of fun. And
yeah, I do too.
Both that and then this Don Byas Sessions, it's on the 53-54. She plays Lullaby of the Leaves, which as a young kid who got some kind of 14th reissue of the early Jerry Mulligan quartet sides, their take on that is indelible. And it's always made it kind of a standard that's got a special place in my heart. And she clearly likes it and has fun with it in very different ways on those two recordings. All right, where would we go? Where should we go next?
Let's talk about the Button Pal.
Okay, sure.
We both, probably most of our listeners are aware of, and we both like Bud Powell, but most of our listeners are aware of, you know, Bud's terrible, his tragic life story in a number of ways. He suffered enormously in his lifetime, and the latter half of his career is not a pretty sight, and there are some things that were committed to music,
tape, recordings, yeah.
Yeah, that shouldn't have been. Someone should have just burned the masters. Just things that don't reflect well on him at all. But this is not that. This is Bud when he was the fastest gun on the block, not named Art Tatum. And holy shit, I've just forgotten. Because I've listened to a fair amount, and for whatever reason, in the rotation of late, I've had more of the later Bud, where Bud's a little more broken and a little more contemplative. You know, the highs are still pretty high, but the lows are pretty fucking low. And it's been a while, quite a long while, since I listened to this. And I just forgot how fucking fast he is. And I think I've decided, in prepping for this podcast, that in fact, he's too fast for his own damn good. He's certainly too fast for his accompanists. The bass and the drums here are mic'd really low, and it's a damn good thing, because I'm sure they're just gasping for breath. The speed at which he takes these numbers is nothing short of terrifying. I mean, I forgot how fast he was. I really did. Tatum is the only person who's this fast, it seems to me. And I don't think it's necessarily good. I feel like Bud is at 11 or 12 here on the speed gauge, and I want him at about a 9, an 8. You know, he takes T for 2 at a tempo that, I mean, is just not human. It's just not human. And I feel like sometimes the speed at which he plays things compromises his melodic invention, and that it becomes almost speed for speed's sake. He's enjoying it. He's clearly having fun. He's clearly at his energetic best. But I also feel like it's a little bit like someone who's a little manic. This all feels terribly manic to me in a way that Art Tatum never feels manic. Art Tatum feels magisterial. Tatum takes things in just ridiculously fast, and then he'll double time it. He'll go even faster. But he always feels like he's in complete and total control, and he has this ability to make sort of harmonic and melodic leaps that are just kind of jaw-dropping. Like, you never have the sense that he's not in complete and total control of what he's doing, that he could play it faster still if he wanted. Like, you never get the sense that Art is out of control. And Bud feels just on the edge of out of control here to me. So I like this, and when I hear it, I do tend to stop. These things are in a mix list, and they sort of pop up. But whenever the Bud pops up, especially after Mary Lou Williams, I do kind of sit back.
It's like, whoa.
You know, it's like, whoa, you know, but I'm like, God damn. You can almost hear the bass player just like, you can almost hear him looking at the drummer like going, what the fuck am I supposed to do? Like, how am I supposed to keep time for this guy? You know, how do I, is it possible to keep time for someone who's this fast? I'm a little surprised at my reaction, you know, because we all think the early Bud is the great Bud, but I actually think the early Bud might be a little too fast for his own good. I like the slightly broken, but not totally broken Bud a little bit better. Is that wrong? Is that wrong, Pat?
That's right. You're going to have to live with yourself with that decision, and I'm just sorry I can't help you. You know, when you discuss Let's Do Some Bud, it's almost overwhelming because he is, and I go into this at great length, you'll think I do on this podcast, but if you want even more, years and years ago, I wrote a comparative review of the Verve box set and the Blue Note box set. Verve has a 5-disc set. Blue Note has a 4-disc set that came out about the same time. This might have been, good Lord, 20 years ago or more. And All About Jazz has that review archived. I'd forgotten entirely that I ever submitted it to them. So it's on there. And that's kind of the core of his stuff. For me, the other crucial documents are some early sides he cut with Sonny Stitt, which are in this manic mode. And then he does some live shows at Birdland in 1953. And my particular versions of those are on Fresh Sound, but I'm sure there have been other boots of those, Air Checks. And they're very, very good, but he is a little calmer. And so, you know, when you say, well, let's do some, I'm trying to think, well, what do we do? There are Bud albums, but by the time he's making albums per se, for the most part, they are a little bit later. And probably some of his most famous sessions, I think it is Fats Navarro on that with Sonny Rollins. There's an early session he does on Blue Note, which is fantastic music, but there, I think, above any other recording I can think of, the Blue Note's disfavoring of piano comes through. It's recorded like a typical quintet date, and Rudy's making all, I think it was Rudy, I don't know, was paying all the attention to the trumpet and the tenor, and poor Bud is kind of back in the mix, and it's hard to tell he's even the leader.
You're right. Those are the amazing Bud Powell discs, and I actually like those quite a bit. But those are the ones you're talking about with Sonny and Fats.
It is Fats, okay.
It is Fats on Volume 1. Volume 2, they're gone, and it's just trio at that point. And as I recall, Volume 2 is a little more listenable in some ways than Volume 1 because he's a little higher in the mix. There's less to distract you. But I like those two Blue Notes quite a bit.
Yeah, and those might be better aesthetic documents than these early Verve sides. I mean, for me, the Verve ones, it's just this is how I got to know him. This was my first exposure to him. And I'd say, you know, early grad school years, I went through a phase of a year or two where I just really kind of obsessed about him, trying to figure him out, trying to get all the recordings I could. He is a tough nut to crack. And I think I was asking exactly the questions you were as I listened to this first disc. It's amazing, but is it good? And to me, I guess these trio sides, I think they probably underfeature him as composer a little bit. We do get Parisian Thoroughfare, which is an amazing tune that I think Brownie and Max Roach do that one in their quintet sessions. It's really a standard worthy kind of tune. But some of his other recordings on Poco Loco and Glass Enclosure, which apparently was written to commemorate the time a club owner kept him more or less locked up in an apartment between performances. He had a shitty life. So I guess it was kind of Bud at his absolute technical peak. Yeah. But it raises the questions of the rest of his career, as you say, that there is. I mean, I think the reason, you know, I don't know whether his finger speed exceed some other performers like Phineas Newborn or Tatum. It's just he sounds faster because it is kind of frantic. There's a pushing behind it, an emotion that gives it this kind of edge, an edge of risk, among other things, that it's all going to collapse. And so it rivets, yeah.
When he plays Get Happy, it's like you say, come on, no, really, I want you, Get Happy. No, Get Happy, come on right now, Get Happy. You know, it's like someone's like grabbing you by the shoulder and shaking you. It's just manic. It's like someone who's slightly strung out, they're like a piano wire about to break. Great, you know, April in Paris, Body and Soul. These are not brisk numbers.
Right.
But when Bud plays them, holy shit.
Well, he does have a side where he will play, and that was always confusing to me about him, because when he does go into ballad mode, it seems very different from his bebop mode in that it's kind of lush and romantic and maybe overripe.
It's like Monk, but with all the notes in.
Yeah, and they are close. He plays some Monk. And you know, you mentioned Tatum. I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, there's a story where Tatum heard him play, and his comment was, "Where's your left hand?" Because, of course, because you know, Bud, in a sense, is one of the founders of the bebop piano style, where you're playing these amazing lightning lines in your right hand, and really kind of punctuating harmonically with the left.
Brad Meldow famously said, your left hand becomes a claw.
Right, yeah. And of course, Meldow is one of these figures who then decides he is going to get out of that box. And, right. You know, he's famous for his independent movement, the two hands, and his ability, which is just kind of mind-bending to kind of have two different musical lines and rhythms and everything going at once. But yeah, Powell is somebody who streamlines piano in a way to make it work. It's sort of a horn-based style, right? It's you can imagine if someone was born with fingers like God, he could transcribe some of these solos. And I'll tell you, some of Bud's charts, just playing the chart is kind of like, whoa! He is kind of, in a sense, if you want bebop in essence, maybe even more than Parker, early Bud is kind of, wow. And he is, I think, in terms of, I don't know whether coherence, but just, I do feel like, and maybe it's got to do with the fact I've listened to him for so long, but that his playing does have a striking quality to me, that I think that he does find phrases that I remember. And maybe it's just the drivenness of the playing. So that it, you know, you can hear bebop piano became such a cliche after a while, and that approach, there's so many people who've played in that style. But for me, Bud has got something extra, and I think part of it's just he's maybe a little bit more melodically inventive, and some of it's just sheerly that it is so fraught, it's so intense, and it's not completely controlled. You know, he was subject, and I cannot remember the date, to a very brutal beating by a police officer, and I really don't know whether that is the foundation of his various mental problems, the cause is brain damage, or whether he struggled with them before.
The beating happened in 1945.
In any case, he struggled. He was a disturbed guy, and obviously a lot of it had to do with just the brutality he encountered and the racism that he was constantly encountering, and the special difficulty, I guess everybody suffers in that kind of a system who's subject to it, but artists can be pretty high strung when everything's great and they're being fed bonbons by their, you know, their supporters, much less when they're going through this kind of hell.
So he got, when he was hospitalized, I think I have this right, didn't he get electroshock therapy?
Yeah, he was, and of course, it's interesting that is gone from being seen as just the absolute cruelest, craziest thing to do to now, you know, I had an uncle who actually, that was the only thing that helped him with his depression towards the end.
I've heard that there are therapeutic uses for it. It sounds like weird science, but in fact, I believe some people who have certain forms of schizophrenia or dissociative disorders. Some people, yeah, depression is one thing that still is treated that way. And I think certain forms of schizophrenia are still treated that way with some success, I think.
But that said, that was not what was being done to Bud, you know, my guess. This was not the enlightened shock therapy. So yeah, there was a movie out many decades ago now starring Dexter Gordon called Round Midnight. Yes. And that's kind of it kind of melds together some of Dexter's story with Bud's. So that's kind of a fictionalized take on it. And I believe Bud is one of those figures who is covered in that book, But Beautiful, that has the various profiles, the very subjective, kind of imaginative profiles of various jazz musicians from their points of view. I like this record. It always is very striking. I would agree that it is also kind of frantic. And yeah, I don't know aesthetically whether at that speed he reaps the rewards he might. I mean, I guess part of it is having heard that, everything else just seems a little, I don't know, it's just when you're used to that manic high, then everything else seems a little calmer, a little less colorful in a sense. But he's a hard artist. I see early Blue Notes, the early Verve. I would recommend, if you can track him down, the stuff at Birdland, the stuff with Stitt. But yeah, after that, there's a lot of stuff he did in Europe, and some of it is quite solid. It's not like he just stopped being able to play. Right. It's just not as dramatic. It's not as focused. And there are moments, you know, I talk about, there's a Verve song on one of those discs in the middle that just, you listen to it and you think, it's like listening to a mentally ill person play piano. And it's like, wow, you probably should not have kept that. And this was a phase where Verve would put in everything. Studio chatter, false starts, 3 alternates in a row. Just very kind of hard to maneuver through. So that makes the middle stretch of his career harder to follow if that's the way you're looking at it. But he's an amazing figure. He is probably the least known of the great bebop figures. You know, I think he gets talked about less than Parker or Gillespie or Monk. He's, I think, probably the most interesting composer after Monk. Not that he's prolific, but throwing Glass Enclosure with Parisian Thoroughfare and a few others, and he came up with some interesting tunes. And, you know, people like Chick Corea will dedicate albums to his music. He's not been forgotten. But, yeah, he's tough to get a handle on. And, you know, comparing him to Tatum, I think you could also compare him to Parker. There's that, you know, terrible recording of Loverman where Parker is kind of going into withdrawal and, you know, freaking out. But for the most part, when Parker's playing on a Dial or Savoy or Verve, you know, he's in control. I mean, he woodshedded and woodshedded, and what's kind of amazing about him is the calmness with which he can execute these just unbelievable lines. Not so with Bud. Yeah, I mean, you feel like, whoa.
You always feel like the car is careening toward the edge of the cliff. I would say on all of the stuff, probably from the 50s until the bitter end in 66, I would say if you're trying to decide what to listen to, generally speaking, avoid the live stuff.
Yeah.
He's pretty good on the Dexter Gordon, Our Man in Paris. He's pretty good on that. So go for studio stuff. If it's live, you never know what you're going to get.
Yeah, and again, as one of those bebop founders, I don't know if there's quite the obsession with Gillespie, but certainly with Parker, it's just everything, any air check, any amateur recording is out there. And as you say, it's hard to kind of make your way through it. There's so much. He's not always in good shape, especially as it gets later. That's a good call, the Blue Note, because, you know, there aren't just a lot of obvious Bud albums out there. And because there's so much documentation, you know, you might have 20 or 30 kind of off-brand compilations of his stuff. Where do you go? So you want to move to Fats and Tad here?
Yeah, let's talk about the Tad Dameron piece. I want you to start by saying something about arrangers and just the art of arrangement, because that really is what Dameron is famous for. And there are only a handful of people whose reputation stands and falls on their ability to arrange music as opposed to being a player. Gil Evans, to give a handful of others, you know, to a certain extent, Duke Ellington, although he's a composer, right? Dameron, maybe Fletcher Henderson, people who are known for being able to arrange music. Say, can you talk about that a little bit? Like, what makes someone a good arranger? Why do we venerate arrangers?
Well, and Tad is a composer arranger. I mean, he writes a lot of these tunes. To me, I guess I came at it in terms of, I guess, the temperature of this music. And I guess with a jazz arranger, the big problem you're facing is creating a structure that has its own intrinsic interest, some harmonic movement, interesting lines for the horns, maybe a riff or two that kind of gives a framework for the music. You know, we were talking about the soul box last time, and you know, Bob James sometimes would come up with, like for Don't Explain, he's got his own little melodic motif that he introduces and just plays through its variations for minutes before the actual melody of Don't Explain comes on. I mean, he's maybe overdoing it, but he's really bringing a lot of his own material to that arrangement. Tad, you know, he said he was interested in pretty, and what fascinates me about him is that he's talented at what he's doing in terms of creating these structures that both have their intrinsic interest, but, and I guess I should get to that second part, leave musicians room to breathe and to play, right? A jazz arranger's got a different job than, I don't know, a movie music arranger. They've got to leave gaps for the individuals who are playing the arrangement to fill in and to elaborate on, or the jazz musicians won't like it. They're like, you know, I got in this music to be creative, not to just kind of execute. And he, you know, he does that. It's typically what you have are statements of the melody with some, you know, harmonic collaborations, and then, you know, rooms for solos. And I guess I'd have to go think back, you know, how much there's maybe a little arranging to kind of frame the various soloists. What's odd about Tad is he comes up at a time precisely when the whole idea of arranging is being questioned, right? I mean, the bebop revolution, one thing I notice about it is that it's literally play the head together in unison, very fucking fast, once, and then string of solos. There are no riffs, there are no frames, there are no introductions, there are no conclusions, they're just melody, string of solos, melody again. And I kind of think of that as a reaction against the big band years where 90% of it was arrangement and frame, and then you had your 8 or your 16 bars to play something. And then it was absorbed back in this larger fabric. And it was basically, you know, music for entertaining dancers. It was not, strictly speaking, an art music. You know, I don't even, you know, big band, you might argue, is not really jazz at all. It's just music that has some of the rhythmic ideas of jazz and includes some improvisation, but it's basically the popular music of its time. But Tad, coming up in this generation, doesn't want to give all that up. And his tone, I mean, we're in a different mood world, feel world. I'm running out of words, maybe because it's early in the morning here in Sweden. It's just a different temperature, this music. It's a little bit relaxed. It doesn't have the bebop freneticism. I don't think it's quite like cool jazz. It's not quite the Miles Davis Nonet, but it's not miles removed from that. You feel like he, in a sense, is kind of really the precursor to that.
I think that's right. He's got a kind of plummy sound. I mean, I can hear the Nonet. I can hear Gil Evans in this stuff. It has a kind of plummy sound, but it doesn't have a real heavy brass bottom.
No, you know, yeah.
I always, when I think of Ellington as an arranger, I think of the Winds, those reed players he had who could all double and triple on a whole bunch of things. And not that Ellington wasn't a great arranger for horns, but I really think of his saxophone sections, you know, and the sometimes the exotic instruments he brought to bear And when I think about the Nanette or Gil Evans, you think more about that sort of plummy, fruity sound that he got with French horn and tuba sort of rounding out the sound. And Dameron has a little bit of that. It's just not as bottom heavy, but it has that sort of plummy sound. I read that players and his groups loved his arrangements. As a player, what makes an arrangement lovable? Like, what makes an arrangement as a player lovable? Why do you go, ah, yes, yeah.
Hard to say. I think that it literally is, does the person have good ideas? I mean, are you playing something that is stating a, man, it's completely subjective. So my example would be, we went to a concert here a couple weeks back that had Nielsen's, one of his symphonies, and this piece by a Frenchman that was kind of written in the classical style. And the whole time, I just wanted to shoot myself because it was so fucking dull. It was just like, he was just running the changes of da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know. And it's like, there's just no inspiration. It's mechanically, it was solid, but the difference between him and Mozart is genius. It's just, you know, the music is unfolding in a way that seems organic. It just doesn't seem like you're mechanically running through a harmonic idea. There's some element of surprise. And let's face it, there are just some melodies and that when you hear them, they're indelible, and some that just slide off you like Teflon. And yeah, Dameron, he is taking big band language to some degree, you know, da-da-da, da-da-da-da. You know, that's, in a way, it's not miles removed from a big band riff, but he's found a way to make it hip for the late 40s. It doesn't sound like Fletcher Henderson or Benny Goodman or whatever. And the harmonies are just fresh enough and bebop enough. You know, he's using more complex inner voices. As I mentioned, you know, when I'm playing a Gil Evans arrangement, I played one of the arrangements from the Birth of the Cool section, and the alto part there, the whole time I'm like, oh no, man, that's a fucking wrong note. That's got to be wrong. Is that, you know, it's like, they're all incredibly fucking wrong notes if you're playing the harmony line to one of these arrangements, but they all sound brilliant within the context. When you're playing a third rate arranger, every note you play sounds fine. You know, it's just, it's obvious. It's like the third, you know, or something. It's a harmony that is completely inoffensive and blends in and never surprises you, but the end result is very predictable. Whereas the end result of, can't remember which one it was now, maybe in Boplicity, I'm not sure, but one of those Birth of the Cool tunes, a handful of notes I was playing every time just sounded, by themselves, knowing the melody in my head, playing the harmony part, if I just played it, sounded horribly wrong. But the thinking was at a high enough level that when you took all those nine voices into account, it sounds fucking brilliant. So I'm assuming that's the best I can say, that he was able to give musicians interesting things that did not seem predictable, did not seem rote, but there is that geniality, that kind of warmth, that relaxation, and that sense of something that is striving for beauty. I mean, in a sense, bebop is not interested in traditional beauty at all, right? Even the ballad playing, which can be gorgeous, it's very intellectual. And Dameron is like, he's the first, I think, in a sense. I mean, you could say that, you know, maybe Gil Evans has some Dameron in him, right? You know, that
sounds right.
You know, he's getting this mood, and it's not quite as, I don't, European, artsy, I don't know what to say, quite as rounded off as the sound that you'll get with like the Birth of the Cool recordings. It's a little bit more firmly in the jazz vernacular, but yeah, he's questing for that. And boy, in the midst of the heat of the bebop revolution, working with a player like Fats Navarro, who could fucking burn, he finds a way to kind of create this mood world, the sound that no one's trying for. I mean, you got the big band, which is just at this point, ossified cliche. You've got the beboppers who are just trying to strip all that away and leave nothing but just high intensity, harmonically thorny improvising. And then here's Tad. He's like, well, what about this? And he doesn't get a lot of notice, but shit, you know, it's like he, in a sense, it's not hard bop, it's not cool jazz, but it's like the first step saying bebop is an aesthetic just, and maybe that was the point of the Bud Powell stuff, by itself, it's just too rigid. I mean, I remember reading part of this profile of Mary Lou that she's getting tired of bebop very quickly because she sees it as almost too doctrinaire, right? It's just like, this is what you do. You know, you play really convoluted harmonic variants on I've Got Rhythm at a super fast pace, and you don't do anything, again, but play the head, solo, play the head. That's all I can say. I mean, I've never played any of his arrangements. His tunes are gorgeous. I mean, he's just a good writer. But to explain why that is, I don't know. It's basically he's smarter than me, you know, and he writes things that are nice to play. It's just like playing a Charlie Parker solo. It's like, why is that more intrinsically satisfying than playing a Dexter Gordon solo? It's just because Parker's just, I don't know. He's got a better, clearer Skype line to God. I don't know. Shit. That's just, yeah, you get to the point where it's like, I can't explain it, but it's, I know it when I hear it. Anyway, a long ramble, but yeah, I think you put your finger on what makes Dameron special. It's not his piano playing, is it? He's not a Bud Powell.
No, that's not what gets people's attention about him. You know, it is interesting. I'm looking at his discography, and there's, I'm curious about, I'm sort of flipping through the Penguins and looking up stuff while you're talking. He has a disc in 62 called The Magic Touch, and it's like a who's who of the Gil Evans set.
Right.
So it's got Julius Watkins, Jerome Richardson. It's got a whole bunch of those guys. I wonder what that sounds like, you know?
It's,
it sound like when
right.
Dameron has those players, many of whom, Jimmy Cleveland, guys who played with Gil Evans. What does it sound like when he gets those guys? Does he do anything new? I don't know. I'm curious about that.
Yeah, it's a good one. Dameron may have had drug problems. I feel like he dies pretty young. What I think happens is when the Birth of the Cool stuff comes out, it pushes things to a kind of that super mellow, light, classically infused sound that, let's face it, appeals a lot to white people. And it becomes, as we've talked about before, kind of a, you know, so many artists on the West Coast, I mean, that's their bread and butter for 10, 15 years. Dave Pell is just nothing but a variant of that. And Dameron is not quite, he's a little more idiosyncratic, and he's just, it just doesn't push it that far. It doesn't, he's mellow, he's pretty, but he's still more, again, as I'd say, there's less European influence, and there's less of that really rounding off of the sound. It's a little bit more straightforwardly jazz. And so I think his problem is, in the marketplace, is that he's not stylized enough. He's not, like, just nailed that extremely stylized version of this melding of that became cool jazz. He's not there. That's not what he's quite after. And so he's not playing hard bop at that point. You know, he's not playing soul music, but he's not quite as cool as a Gil Evans. And, you know, let's face it, that particular album has got Tad on the cover. And so he's not as white as Gil Evans. And I just don't think that it captures people's attention. But the result of that is it still sounds like Tad Dameron. And it doesn't sound that much different from this. It's smoother sounding and it's better recorded. But I don't feel like his conception radically changes. And I don't think the musicians brought on board, they perform beautifully, but they don't make him into a Gil Evans-like figure. He remains very Tad. And there's like that and another short one, I think Fountain Blue or something. Yeah, he does not have an extensive discography. I remember there's a problem you might call reflexive historical revisionism, where people who write criticism feel like they need to question accepted wisdom automatically. And I remember reading a comment saying, some people say Tad Dameron plays arranger's piano, but it's like, no. Take the white out. Remove the but. They're just right. He plays arranger's piano. He's not a good piano player. There's nothing wrong with that, but my God, have you listened to this man play? You know, and I don't want to harp on it. It's just that he's a great, if you're learning about jazz piano and what it sounds like, Tad is like somebody who could get by. And he's on Mating Call with John Coltrane, and that's a 5-song set of Tad Dameron compositions. He's adequate, but he's not great. I mean, that's not what he was born to do. He was born to arrange and write. So yeah, this is a really pleasant. I mean, Navro's on a lot of these cuts. I mean, he makes a lot of recordings with Tad, and then I guess this disc is focused on things that Tad appears on throughout. and Fats is on only some of which. Is that right? This particular Blue Note disc, yeah.
Okay. That's correct, yeah.
And Navro is another player who really kind of fell through the cracks of history. And man, he can fucking play. He's kind of the Clifford Brown before we had Clifford Brown. But he's very fleet, but unlike a Dizzy Gillespie, he's got that kind of a round liquid tone. Very handsome sounding player. Well, any other thoughts on the Tad?
No. That was good. Good job. Good job, you. I like it. That sounds okay. Like early Gill to me, but that's unfair. You should say Gill sounds like late Tad. I don't know. I guess the one thing I would say that I have a hard time with these arrangements, I like them, and when I hear these songs, you know, the squirrel instantly in my head, you know, I immediately hear it, and they're earworms. As arrangers go, he's not as distinctive as some others that we've talked about, or maybe I just haven't spent enough time with him. So when I hear a Gil Evans arrangement, I know it immediately. When I hear a Sun Ra arrangement, I know it immediately. When I hear two bars of an Ellington arrangement, I know it. And when I hear Tad Dameron, I don't know it immediately. And maybe that's just I haven't listened to enough of his stuff, and I can't quite single out what makes him distinct or different. That account you gave, he's in one way a kind of reaction to bebop, saying, hey, let's not just play the head. Let's have something for everyone to play together, and then we'll be some open space for solos. That is kind of in the Ellington mode. The difference being, of course, that Ellington is symphonic in his aspirations with what he does in a 3-minute piece. And you would never accuse Dameron of that. Dameron's arrangements aren't quite that creative. They don't change every 30 seconds. There's a very clear structure to these.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're very logical. And for that reason, I think for a novice or a newbie, they would enjoy these quite a bit. They may never have heard of Tad Dameron, but you can dip in anywhere, I think, and really start to enjoy this right away, because they're very logical, they're very clear. You know, he's got sort of ensemble playing, and they're not all playing the same thing, but they are playing. They're laying out a kind of clear melody, kind of bass that then opens up space for a soloist with some interesting moments. It's not just head solo, head solo. He does have some changes in the middle. Nothing on the order of like an Ellington, right, who will just completely rearrange a sound world in 3 minutes. But for that reason, perhaps, easier to get into and appreciate. So even if you don't know it's Tad Dameron, if you heard it and you're just, you know, a kind of jazz novice and you heard one of these arrangements, you'd go, oh, I kind of like that. So everyone go out and listen to some Tad Dameron. I don't know what else to say. These are very easy to listen to and very enjoyable. I don't find them as moving, or in part because he's not that strange. Ellington is strange. Sun Ra is strange. Gil Evans is really fucking strange when he wants to be. D'Arcy James Argue is really strange. You know, these are right. People who have a very distinctive sound world that you kind of enter into immediately. That's not Tad Dameron, at least not on the listens that I've given to his material. And again, maybe I just need to listen to more.
These particular performances are some of the best bebop that's not by the big three, or if you count Thelonious Four, right? And they aren't as well known because Navro and Dameron aren't as well known figures. But, you know, it's a quintet still. So he doesn't have the resources, even on the couple later albums he does. And I think he does like some arranging for, I can't remember whether it's Jimmy Heath or somebody. You know, he does some other work. But when he's got a couple more horns to work with, it gets a little bit more ambitious. I don't know that he's probably remembered as well as a arranger as he is a composer. Because, you know, he does Hot House, which is a bebop absolute standard. Social Call, there's just a number of tunes that he wrote that he really had a gift for composition and have remained in circulation. When Chet Baker did one of his countless comebacks, I think it was mid-50s for Prestige, he did a series of 5 records. And one thing he does is return to several Tad Dameron compositions on the course of those. And so, you know, that guy's, his work is in circulation from time to time. The one thing to warn you about in this particular compilation is there are a couple vocals.
I think I'll go away, but not for just a while.
I think I'll go away. It's like, please, hurry, go, go, go.
I don't mind those. Are those sort of overripe, fruity vocals? As long as it's not the whole disc, right?
Right. They're just a couple. Exactly. Right. Yeah. If it was a whole disc of that, it would be definitely needle and eye kind of thing. But, and I guess it, the other thing it tells you is that he is, you know, willing to write some pretty sentimental, hard on sleeve romance kind of songs. You know, he is somebody who just said, you know, I'm looking for pretty. You know, this is the term he'd use. So that alone in that particular era was kind of an interesting position to take. Well, the oddity that I asked us to include, basically because it's been around and I want to think about it a little bit more, was Ferret Oatman's Dameronia with Strings. And,
is that how you say his name? I have no idea. I like saying Ferret Oatman because it sounds so fun.
You know, it may... God, Lord. Maybe it is Oatman. I don't know. Whatever the appropriate Turkish pronunciation would be, would be that.
For the class, it's spelled F-E-R-I-T. So however that is pronounced, and Oatman is O-D-M-A-N. So it could be, you know, Ferit Oatman.
Very possible.
Saying Ferret Oatman.
There you go. Because we're ugly Americans. So yeah, he is kind of an audiophile darling because he has his recordings cut to analog tape and he releases them. And he's done three records and he's...
Wait. Tell everyone who's not an audiophile what that means, what you just said.
Okay.
No, seriously.
No. I'm trying to think of what part it was. So, yeah, okay. So, yeah, if you are a sound whore, basically, it is very unusual now to make recordings to analog tape. Typically, people do them digitally. It's a lot easier. Mike and I don't have giant Revox machines here picking up the vibes. We're doing it onto our hard disk drive. Some people believe that if you keep the chain all analog, in other words, you never digitize the signal, you just cut it to... you know, tape that is like a supercharged, much, much, much better high-quality version of a cassette, right? A great big reel instead, and it's moving very fast, and it's capturing a lot of information. And then send that to a lathe to cut an album, and you've never put it in the digital domain, that you capture something that gets lost with digitization. I don't know if that's true. I've heard a lot of really good-sounding digital recordings and a lot of good analog ones, but this fascinates people who think about sound 24/7. And I tend to read about these people, though I'm not quite one of them. So anyway, that's how I found out about it.
Unconvincingly.
Yeah. No, I can't even, I cannot compete, you know. It's like, and then I positioned the speaker another quarter of an inch to the, I'm like, okay, I just put them on some boxes and hope they were okay. But yeah, I do, it fascinates me in part just because the way these guys approach recordings is so distinctive. And it is true, I think, since the last 14 years, I've been more aware of sound quality. I don't think I thought about it at all as a kid. And, you know, now it does matter. It's not the only factor by any means. But so anyway, this is a good sounding recording of a Turkish drummer who I think is, I don't know, fine. I don't think he's an amazing percussionist. And he gets together a bunch of pretty well-known American musicians to cut eight songs by Tad Dameron. There have been other Dameron tribute groups. Philly Joe Jones had one. Which is a strange, yeah, you wouldn't think Philly Joe Jones and Tad Dameron, but
he played with
did.
Him. He played with him on a few discs, a few dates, so yeah.
And there's an album floating around there I've got somewhere. Ferret is, apparently his idol is is Art Blakey, but I wouldn't have guessed that.
Less like Blakey?
I know, he's extremely, kind of a polite, recessive guy. He's not, you know, the comment on any of his sessions would be, this is not like a drummer-led date in the sense, and which is a good choice because...
It's very good, yeah. Although, you know, Blakey also played with Dameron, which is really hard to imagine.
Yeah, it's like, Dameron's like, I like pretty things. Go away, Art.
Pretty things, Art. Take it down.
Yeah, wow. A few fewer press rolls would be nice, sir. So yeah, this is the string arrangements. This is not like an orchestra providing a bed. There's a few string players who will kind of, I don't know, they're not used on every song. I don't think they're overwhelming. What are your general impressions here?
I like this quite a bit. I don't think it's genius, but God, is it pleasant. I mean, it's really pleasant. It's really enjoyable. Terrell Stafford is the trumpeter here, and I like him better on this than on anything I've heard him on before, I think. This idiom suits him. I think I have one or two CDs by him, or I've heard him. I just remember when I realized it was him, I was like, I remember making a lemon face about something of his in the past, and I don't know what I have by him that gave me that impression, but I really like him here. Maybe I'm thinking of someone else who gave me the lemon face, but whatever. I like him here quite a bit. These are, I think, even plummier arrangements than Dameron's arrangements of Dameron's music. And who is the piano player here? The piano player is, he's pretty busy. I don't mind it, though. Stafford is pretty mellow, actually. Stafford is, he's not doing Fats Navarro here. Although, to be fair, Fats Navarro doesn't usually do Fats Navarro on Dameron arrangements. He swings, he's mellow. He's very sort of round, ripe sound here. But the piano player is super busy, and I kind of like that, actually. The strings don't get on my nerves, in part because it's not a whole orchestra. I mean, I think that's good. It's not overwhelming. It's not saccharine. In fact, because there aren't so many, you can hear most of the time it's a violin, a violinist. It's not quite a solo, but they have some grace notes that stand out from the rest of the string arrangement. And I like that. In other words, it sounds like there's seven. I could have done with a little bit more variation in the mood, but that's a minor complaint. I like these. I like this album. Like I said, I don't think it's brilliant. You know, it's not scaling the heights of Olympus of genius, but it's just dead fucking pleasant, and it's always interesting. Like, look, stop, listen. That one opens with as close as you get to a drum solo on this album. And, you know, it's pretty fucking sedate for a drum solo as far as these things go. So, yeah, it's a little bit much of a muchness. That's maybe, I would have liked a little more variety. But I don't know. That seems like carping or trying to find a reason to complain. I like this quite a bit.
Yeah, it's kind of a quick primer on most of Dameron's best-known compositions. Yeah, I think that, as I said, as a drummer, he's okay. He's fine. He's not outstanding, but he does fine. And really, the album's about kind of permission to be pretty. And I feel like it's about finding that mood, that very distinctive mood that Dameron has. And again, that this weird betweenness that it's not bebop, it's not quite cool, it's certainly not hard bop. I mean, there's nothing kind of minor key or funky or ominous or whatever about it. It's, as you say, kind of bright, optimistic sounding music, maybe a little too direct for cool. It's just a very, emotionally, it's a very interesting place. And I tend to associate that time with kind of very late 40s, early 50s music. To some degree, some of Mary Lou Williams stuff from that era. You know, it's got that, it's not tortured like bebop, it's certainly not all about the blues and minor keys the way hard bop is. It's not cool jazz, it's not quite that mentholated. It's just something very distinctive about that moment, you know, the few years that kind of goes away. And I don't know that it can easily be recaptured, and yet this group, I think, really finds itself in that kind of emotional space very readily, and it blends in. I mean, it sounds not sonically, but emotionally, kind of in terms of its loping goodwill, and like Tad Dameron back in the late 40s and early 50s, it kind of finds its place there temperamentally, and that's interesting about the record.
I think also you'd be able to tell in 2 seconds listening to this that it's a modern recording, in part just because of what the strings get up to. Occasionally they're doing pizzicato passages. There's little bits of plucking here and there. you'd never hear it. You'd never even be able to fucking hear that on, you know, one of those four.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Pick that out. The sound here is just really pristine. It's really clear. Although the bass could be louder for my taste, but I guess that's not really what this music is about. So.
Yeah. I get the sense that both the recording technique and I don't know whether Ferret may be a very rich gentleman. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to call this a vanity recording per se, but I kind of get the sense that he must somehow have resources to enable him. I mean, the reason people don't record to analog tape is it's expensive. It's just harder to do it. It takes equipment that is largely out of date and hard to maintain, and the tape itself is not cheap. I mean, it's not like, you know, you can find a big reel of analog tape lying, you know, in your average Radio Shack, mainly because Radio Shack's closed. It's that stuff is harder to do, and I just don't know whether he's got resources that enable him to put together a project like that. I'm not sure how he manages to do it, but his goal seems to be a kind of very mellow, rounded sound. And so, yeah, he doesn't make himself too prominent. The bass isn't super prominent. It's just all very carefully calibrated to kind of give you a very pleasant listening experience without, I think, inducing guilt that you're just listening to schmaltz. An oddity. I mean, he's not a well-known name. He's put out two other records. They're mainly standards. And again, even though his kind of idol is Art Blakey, they don't have that hard bop snarl. They just don't. They sound genial and kind of just gentle. And I think Stafford's on at least one of those. Vincent Herring, I believe, plays alto on the other two. And he's a little, you know, he brings a little vinegar to the proceedings. But yeah, just a perfect melding of the personality of the leader here, and then, of course, the object of the dedication. I mean, he really, I think, gets something about Ted Dameron's mood very, very well. All right. Well, do you got any pop matters to discuss?
Yeah, I listened to a few new things, some of which might interest you. I listened to a fairly recent Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers album, and it's the best one I've heard in quite some time, called Hypnotic Eye. I think it's quite strong. Tom Petty's albums often sound much of a muchness, but this sounds just a little bit more of a muchness. I don't know. I like it quite a bit. And I don't know if you've heard of the Black Keys, but I've been getting into them recently. Two white guys from Brooklyn, of course, I think from Brooklyn. Isn't everyone from Brooklyn? sort of doing garage, the Jack White garage band thing. But they're pretty good. I've got two of their discs now, and I think I might like one a little bit better than the other. I'm still making up my mind, but they're both very fine. Leonard Cohen's, I picked up his last disc before he died, called You Want It Darker, and at this point, he's basically talk singing, but when your voice is so low that it sounds like your bowels are dropping out on the floor, you're allowed to talk sing. He can talk sing all he wants. It's just human beings don't talk that low. It's like his balls dropped, and then they dropped again, and then they just fell to the center of the earth. Like on this album, his voice is actually lower than I've ever heard it before. I mean, I don't know how they even get it to record.
That whale song.
You could almost hear the one vocal cord he's got left slowly vibrating as air pulses over it. It's just his voice. You could read the phone book. It's not a bad album, actually. I kind of like it. But I got a couple of jazz things that I wanted to mention to you, one of which we might have to put on the podcast. This Canadian girl, another one of these jazz teenage prodigies, her name is Nikki Yanofsky.
Okay.
And this was a live date. I actually have the CD with the DVD, which I can't bring myself to watch. She recorded this when she was 13.
Ooh, okay.
And it's called Ella of the Ice Swing. So here's what I have to say about Nikki Yanofsky. We probably have to do a podcast about her. She's, I think, 16 now. She has a voice as big as a fucking house at 13. Oh my God. She sounds like she could, she doesn't need a mic. I mean, she's got a huge voice. However, she has a very shrill voice. And unfortunately, there are some song choices here that no 13-year-old should be allowed to perform in public. Like, At Last?
Maybe At First?
Now, she's got this soaring when she breaks into those. She says she actually she's got this chipmunk voice when she talks. Like, after every song, she says, thank you. Like, she's so surprised that people are clapping. And maybe she is. I mean, she seems bubbly and genuine. No doubt her parents are managing her, whatever. I mean, I'm not insulting her. I'm just saying she's this very bright, bubbly personality, which doesn't at all go with this gigantic voice that's coming out of this small person. But when she introduces At Last, unfortunately, she doesn't introduce most of the numbers. Like, she's like on a schedule. Like, you know, there's an arranger running the show and she's just performing. But on At Last, she says, now, I know this song is a little mature for me, but whenever I sing it, I think about my dog.
Okay. Mandy, you gave and you gave without taking.
I mean, I didn't know what to think about that. So some of the songs, she just shouldn't be singing. She just shouldn't. Smartly, they have her singing some things she should be singing. Like, if ever someone should sing A Tisket, A Tasket, it's a 13-year-old.
Yeah.
Right in her wheelhouse. Somewhere Over the Rainbow, fine. Perfect. Flying Home, that's okay. Old MacDonald, not the Frank Sinatra version.
Good.
Perfectly fine. Perfectly fine. There are some other things I'm like, no, they should not. Her closer is With Little Help from My Friends.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Oh, I get by with a little help from my friends.
Okay.
The 13-year-old should not be channeling Joe Cocker. It's just, that should not be happening. I want to hear this girl's voice when she's 30, when she's had some more training and she's actually had her heart broken or fallen in love once or twice. And then I want to hear her sing At Last. That I really do. So yeah, it's just this uncanny voice. I mean, it's just uncanny, but also kind of just shrill. Like, there's not a lot of control of dynamics yet.
Damn. You know?
She's got the brass, but she doesn't have, like, you know how, like, really good jazz singers can drop low or sing quiet. She doesn't have that yet. She's not there.
I'm thinking of Diane Schur at a jazz fest in Chicago many, many years ago, where the sound was of a cat being twirled by his tail. So I'm like, row, row. That's terrible. But yeah,
that doesn't happen. So anyway, I mean, she's as cute as a button, and I don't wish her ill at all. It's just, I do want life to happen to her.
Sure.
And then hear that voice after life happens to her. That'll be really interesting. And then, and that's not really a pop matter, but it's, you know, she sings some pop songs. So it's, but today I was listening to, and I don't remember if I ever shared this with you, Gaetano Veloso's A Foreign Sound, which.
I think you have. I think so. It's kind of like.
Yeah, he's a really important Brazilian world music singer. He's, I think, 75 now, but he's terribly important, terribly significant. But if you want to hear this guy's voice, and it's just absolutely best, this is the album to get. It is. I think he's extraordinary. He's got, talk about someone who has dynamic control, who can sing soft, high, loud, fast, slow. I mean, this guy's voice, he can play it like a Stradivarius. And he's completely unashamed to sing songs. So, you know, some people will change the lyrics of jazz songs when they sing them to match gender. He doesn't give a fuck. He sings The Man I Love like he's singing to the man he loves.
And okay.
It's fucking fantastic. And his version of Love for Sale is just jaw-dropping.
Love for sale. Appetizing young love for sale. love that's fresh and still unspoiled, love that's just slightly soiled. Love for sale.
It's just amazing. This is a great, great, great album. So a lot of jazz standards here, but then, you know, he covers Nothing But Flowers by Talking Heads. Terrific. He covers Love Me Tender.
Okay.
Fantastic. He covers It's All Right, Ma, I'm Only Bleeding. You know, I mean, holy shit. Jamaica Farewell. This little banana boat song. He's just truly a kind of, he's just not afraid of any kind of song. And he brings his own thing to whatever he sings. This has to be the sweetest version of Nature Boy I've ever heard. His version's only 2 minutes long and it's almost happy. It's really hard to say. And unfortunately, perhaps the nadir of the album, only because he treats it seriously. He sings Feelings.
Do you remember Feelings?
Oh, I sure do. I used to have them when I was younger. I don't anymore, but
yes. It's just feelings. Not a song you want to hear someone who's really good sing, because he treats everything like it's good and he treats it like it's a good song. He also sings, he covers Nirvana. He sings Come As You Are. It's fantastic. If I ever share this with you, you need to dig it out and listen to it again. He's just such a fucking genius. And I guess he's 75. He's going to die one of these days and it's going to be a loss, because I think he's extraordinary and just a genius singer who's really able to do kind of whatever he wants. And there doesn't seem to be a song he can't sing credibly, with the exception of Feelings, and that's not really his fault.
That can't be fixed.
There's nothing he can do to make it better. That's right. What have you been listening to?
Saw you at the farm, picture on a closed circuit. Boy, you lost it all, thinking you could rework it. Stole a credit card and ran away. Back in Louisville, they call the play. And now.
So, not a lot. I did listen to Amy Mann's most recent albums. I got Mental Illness from eMusic, and then I looked up Charmer on Spotify, and those are the two I had not heard. And Charmer, from a few years back, is more in the mold of the guitar pop Amy, and then Mental Illness is almost a folksy record. It's much more acoustic and laid back. And yeah, I guess my sense has been ever since Bachelor Number 2 that she kind of hit a peak. I love her first few records. I've enjoyed every one of her records, but I don't know that she's grown a lot since Bachelor Number 2. I remember Lost in Space just thinking, okay, you finally got the first success of your life, and then this album is just so incredibly depressed. It just seems perverse. You're getting stuck in place.
She's busy breaking up with that guy from Dave Gregory. She's busy breaking up with the XTC guy.
Is that right? Okay. Well, she can do it off off record, maybe. And yeah, these are, of course, she is just the most melancholy human who ever lived. I mean, that is her adjective. She's just incredibly melancholy. The songs sound like Amy Mann songs. There's certain progressions and tonalities that she likes, mainly minor. And yeah, I enjoy them both. I don't know. Ghost World is just a great song. I don't know that I've heard a great song out of her in the last few albums. So I liked them. And then I can match your 13-year-old Canadian tit for tat, but not for talent. We went after we last talked, to the Lund Culture and Street Fest. I don't know. It's hard to know exactly what it was called because I don't know my Swedish very well, meaning at all. But try to figure out what that was. So we went downtown, and there's like a square I know really well, kind of a market square. It's all cobblestone, and on one side of it is a big grocery store and some other stores, and the other side of it is, I'm not sure whether it used to be a grain hall or whatever, but it's now kind of a mini mall in a sense, with various businesses. You can buy Thai food or chocolate or raw fish, and you can get alcohol up the stairs. And on the square, instead of having the vegetable stands out, they put a couple small music performance areas up. And in the evening, they had I guess, Swedish rock bands. I don't know. One was all instrumental. One had vocalists. They were fine. But in the afternoon, the three acts we saw briefly were all kids from about 12 to 14 or 15 playing instrumental music. And occasionally they have a singer. All three of the groups I saw had a girl drummer. And in the first one, it was like two guys from the Goonies. And then this really gorgeous 12 or 13-year-old girl drummer. Didn't have a great sense of rhythm, but my God, she was cutie. The highlight of it was the third group I saw, and there's a guitarist who's a little bit bigger. He looked like he might be 15. He looked like he might be shaving soon. And he was a pretty decent Niles Rogers-style rhythm guitarist. And he decided that their little group should play Superstition. And so the vocalist is like this 13-year-old blonde, because she's Swedish, and my God, a huge percentage of Swedish people are blonde. Girl up there trying to sing it, and the drummer is trying to play it, and it is the least funky thing I've ever heard. But the guitar player was doing pretty well, because they started it up before she started singing. I'm like, man, that sounds like, that sort of sounds like funk, sort of, but wrong, but is that, are they trying to do funk? And then it was like Superstition. And so I'm standing there and I realize most of the crowd, it's not a big area, it's probably parents. And then they finish and she says like, Swedish, 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 Stevie Wonder, Swedish, Swedish, Superstition. And I got to the point where I was crying and laughing at the same time. And I'm like, Joyce, you got to get me out of here, or these parents are going to beat the shit out of me. But it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. It was the cutest thing I'd ever seen. I mean, they could not play funk to save their lives, except for this guitar player. But there's something really hilarious about a little 13-year-old Swedish girl singing Superstition off-key. It just, wow. And none of them, except for the guitar player, mostly they weren't good. They were okay. It was just sort of the dog on its hind legs thing. It's like, it's amazing that a 12-year-old can play at all. But you know, I wasn't looking at the new geniuses. But I mean, there were just apparently an endless supply of these. So I don't know whether there is really a school of rock in London. Then that's where Jack Black is teaching these kids to like try to pretend they're, I don't know, the Eurythmics or something. It's just, it's bizarre. I mean, you don't see this. I mean, this was really the equivalent of like the Strawberry Fest in Crawfordsville. It's like a few stands up selling really, really naughty food and people milling about and a little light drinking, which is not allowed at the Strawberry Fest, alas. And then these performances, which are, I assume, local kids. But it's in Sweden, and they're trying to do Stevie Wonder, and it was just amazing. Wow, it was amazing.
Well, to our legion of Swedish listeners, I just want to say, send your cards and letters to care of Patrick, the Swedophobe, the Swede rockophobe. Don't, it wasn't me. Don't blame me. I
hey,
didn't say it.
I'm acknowledging the adorability. I'm just saying that. Oh my God. I was like, okay, get me out of here because somebody's going to see.
Do we have a Swedish listener yet? Do we have one yet?
You know, I don't know. There's a gentleman who wrote us who's an expat American who lives in Copenhagen. So we got one close to Sweden anyway.
Is it Copenhagen? Oh, I guess it's Denmark.
Denmark. It is. It is.
Spawn people straight.
It is. Okay. But we are like 45 minutes by train from Denmark. We are the southern tip of Sweden. We're like 10 minutes from Malmö, which is the port city that there's literally a bridge across that you can take that will get you to Copenhagen. So
you're the epididymis on the testicles of Sweden.
Okay. Wow. I'm going to be looking some words up today. I've never heard testicles before. And that concludes episode 126 of the Jazz Bastard podcast. As always, you can reach us at mike@jazzbastard.com or pat@jazzbastard.com, or just drop in on our Facebook page and leave a comment or a question. You can download the podcast from www.jazzbastard.com or from iTunes or from whatever Apple's replacing iTunes with. They're always up to something over there, aren't they? We're also hoping that All About Jazz will start hosting a monthly summary of our podcasts, and it sounds like they're going to embed players, so you could also listen to the podcasts there. So that'll be a monthly, two or three podcast summary in a cluster rather than an every 2 week publication schedule. There are some reviews up there as well, if you'd like to check those out. Tune in next time for a podcast devoted to the music of Jerry Allen, piano player who passed away this year. And we'll be looking at some of her early work through the lens of an article by pianist Ethan Iverson. Till next time, take care.